In Florida this weekend, IndyCar racers will take their places for the first competition since the death of a champion. Last fall, two-time Indy 500 winner Dan Weldon was killed in a 15-car crash on a Las Vegas track.
Open the up in front of him, and he... Oh, here we go. Trouble contact and a huge crash. Up in turn number two. Oh, multiple cars involved.
Weldon's death, seen live on ESPN, generated a major debate in the sport about safety. Here to talk more about it is Ryan McGee. He's the senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. And Ryan, to begin, tell us, what are the factors that are believed to have caused the crash that ended Dan Weldon's life?
Well, unfortunately, it was just kind of a perfect storm scenario, and it's something that a lot of people had kind of feared down in their gut for a while, which is when you take these cars, which have big, giant, exposed tires, and you have them racing in close quarters on a high-banked racetrack, primarily built for stock car racing, everybody knows that once those exposed tires touch, you have the potential for catastrophe.
So, Ryan, what are some of the safety precautions or changes that the league has made as a result?
Well, the biggest thing that you can see immediately is with the race car itself. They call it open-wheel racing, because those tires have always been exposed, going all the way back to the first IndyCar races at the turn of the last century. Well, now those rear tires are essentially covered. They're still exposed on the top half, and now there's a rear bumper that goes around behind those tires. And the important thing to know here is this car is called a DW12 for Dan Weldon, his initials. And the reason is because IndyCar brought Dan in to be the test driver to shake down all these potential new chassis. And it's the irony of ironies, and it's sad, but ultimately I think his legacy will be that he's the driver that put this car on the racetrack.
Now, shortly after the race that killed Dan Weldon, we spoke to one of the racers who survived the crash. His name is Will Power, and he spoke about the dangers of racing the old-style car, Indy cars, on NASCAR tracks.
These high-banked ovals, you run 200 laps, inches apart, side by side, two wide, three wide, six deep. It's too fast and too close. Pack racing Indy cars, it's just no room for error, and there's just no question that something has to change.
That's racer Will Power talking about IndyCars racing on NASCAR tracks, specifically high-banked, oval-shaped tracks. Ryan, why the attachment to NASCAR tracks?
Well, they're exciting, and it's dangerous, and that's part of the thrill of it for race fans. But at the end of the day, you're talking about cars with exposed tires where the driver's head is exposed, and they're racing, in some cases, 30 miles per hour faster than a NASCAR stock car is. And Will made a comment. He said high-banked, and he talked about pack racing. The idea was that Indy cars would run down on the flat part. Well, of course not. The fast groove is up on the high banks. That's where they're always going to run. And so that's where they're going to be, and they're going to be in a pack, and it creates dangerous situations. So that's why they're starting to get away from that now.
And there's still five races scheduled for NASCAR tracks this year, correct?
Five races on ovals, that's right. But I would only classify one of those five ovals as a quote-unquote NASCAR track, and that would be the Texas Motor Speedway. And it's banked, has high banks. And in the past, open-wheel racers have said this is a dangerous place, and now they have fuel for that argument. And there's concern that there could be some sort of boycott or walkout. We'll see. Perhaps cooler heads will prevail when we get to Texas in June. But I know for a fact the folks that run that speedway are worried about what could potentially be a walkout when we get to next June.
Ryan McGee, he's senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. Ryan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Henry Louis Gates Jr. has been helping African Americans trace their roots. Now he is broadening the search to include people like Barbara Walters, Congressman John Lewis, and comedian Margaret Cho. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we will have the latest in a series of conversations we've been having about what may be the most high-profile Supreme Court case in years. Next week, the Supreme Court will hear arguments for and against the Affordable Care Act. That's the landmark law that supporters call one of the most significant pieces of legislation in a generation, but which opponents tend to deride as Obamacare. The justices could decide to throw out key provisions or perhaps the entire health policy law. We spoke yesterday to Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian research and policy group that is among the dozens of organizations who have filed briefs opposing the law. For a different perspective, we are joined now by Neil Kutchell. He is the former acting Solicitor General of the United States under President Obama. He defended the Affordable Care Act in lower courts, including the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. He's also a professor at the Georgetown Law Center and a partner with the firm Hogan Lovells. And he's with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
As, of course, you know, one of the most controversial elements of the Affordable Care Act is the whole question of the individual mandate. Opponents are arguing that this simply exceeds the authority of the federal government to impose such a mandate. What's the argument against that?
I think the most important thing the Supreme Court will be thinking about is kind of, can they really remove this issue from the democratic process and say, this law of Congress is unconstitutional. Now, with respect to the individual mandate, what Congress was doing in the Affordable Care Act is it said that there are 50 million Americans who lack health insurance right now, largely because they're priced out of the health insurance markets. And the result of that is that when those 50 million Americans get sick, they go to the emergency room and other places, and you and I, American taxpayers, basically foot the bill for that in the form of higher insurance premiums. Congress found that it is $43 billion in uncompensated care that happen each year, and that the average American family spends $1,000 more in health premiums to pay for this. So what Congress said in the Affordable Care Act is we got to get rid of that. And the way to get rid of it is to end this practice of insurers discriminating against those with pre-existing conditions. They said we shouldn't have that happen. So they prohibited that. But they knew that seven states had done precisely that and had led to a disaster, because in those seven states, what happened is people waited to sign up for insurance until they got sick. They'd literally wait until they were in the ambulance to sign up. It's kind of like if an insurance company is told you have to issue a policy for fire insurance to anyone who wants one, you'll wait until your house is on fire until you sign up for it. The one state that worked was the state that did something different, and that was Massachusetts. And what they did was they said, okay, we're going to ban discrimination against those with pre-existing conditions and require all insurers to insure everyone. But at the same time, we need to avoid that adverse selection problem of people waiting to sign up for insurance only when they get sick. So what we're going to do is we're going to require everyone to have some insurance, a minimum amount of insurance, to avoid that problem. And that worked much, much better than what happened in the other seven states. And that is really the template for what the federal government is doing here.
First, I want to play a short clip from Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute, who spoke to us yesterday, as we said. This is a little of what he told us. Here it is.
If the Supreme Court were to uphold this unprecedented and really breathtaking assertion of government power, there would be nothing to stop the Congress from forcing Americans to purchase any private product that Congress chose to favor. That could be a gym membership. That could be stock in ExxonMobil. That could be broccoli if Congress decided that any of these products move in interstate commerce and that forcing you to buy it was essential to the regulatory scheme they wanted to enact.
What is your response to that?
Well, I mean, that's a lot of rhetoric and not really a legal argument, because it's not responsive to what the government is asking for here. What the government is saying is, look, everyone consumes health care in this country, you and I. And, you know, even if I might say to myself, I don't need health insurance, I won't get sick. The fact is, as human beings with mortality, we are going to get sick, and it's unpredictable when. You could get struck by a heart attack or cancer or hit by a bus and wind up in the emergency room, and then it's average Americans who have to pick up the tab for that. And so the government is not saying here, we have the power to force people to buy goods. They're saying, look, you're going to already buy the good. You're going to use it. And the only question is, are you going to have the financing now to pay for it? And so the government is regulating financing. It's kind of like a government law that said you got to pay cash or credit. It's not the government coming in and saying, oh, consume this product you wouldn't otherwise consume. And as for the kind of, you know, ludicrous suggestion that this would somehow lead to the government forcing people to eat broccoli or the like, I mean, I would think that someone from the Cato Institute would know that the Bill of Rights and the privacy protections in the Constitution would protect against such drastic hypotheticals.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are looking ahead to arguments that are expected to be heard in the Supreme Court next week around the health care law. We're talking about issues on both sides. Yesterday, we spoke with Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank. They are among the groups who have filed briefs opposing the law. With us today, Neil Kutchel, the former acting Solicitor General of the United States. He defended the Affordable Care Act when this case was in the lower courts. He is a professor at Georgetown Law School and a partner in the law firm Hogan Lovells. Could the law still stand apart from the individual mandate?
Well, there are a variety of different positions on this. I mean, the law is 2,400 pages long and has all sorts of stuff that have nothing to do with the individual mandate, things like funding for abstinence education in classrooms and the like. So certainly a good part of the law could stand. I mean, the government's position in the case has been, well, most of the law can stand, but some of it has to go. If the individual mandate goes, so too, the government says, must the provisions that force insurers to insure everyone at a low cost, the so-called guaranteed issue and community rating provisions. And the logic for that is the logic that I said a few minutes ago, which is seven states had tried to do that, to ban discrimination against those with pre-existing conditions and force insurers to insure everyone. But that actually led to a disaster, to an adverse selection problem, whereby people waited to get insurance until it was too late. And so the government's position is, look, if one part goes, then the other goes. I mean, obviously, the government's main view is none of it should go, that this is stuff that's political in nature. And if you don't like the individual mandate, there's a very easy solution, which is you vote President Obama out of office. You know, you vote the members of Congress who voted for it out of office, and you change the law. But you don't let some unelected judges in Washington do the hard work of the democratic process for you.
The Congressional Budget Office is now estimating that the law will cost less than was originally projected, but it still projects a net cost of more than $1 trillion over the next 10 years. And there are those who just argue it's just too expensive, that the free market could do this in a more efficient way, that really, there's still too much government in health care, and that the way to bring costs down is to remove the government footprint even more. What's your response to that, if you feel comfortable offering one?
Well, I would say two things. Number one is that's a really great policy argument, and that's the kind of debate that we should be having in the halls of Congress and all around the country, in classrooms and churches and everywhere else. But those aren't arguments to say something is unconstitutional because it costs too much. Otherwise, you know, we would be declaring wars unconstitutional and other things like that. And certainly I don't think that's where the federal court power should lie. The second thing is just on that policy point, I think there's a real strong divergence of opinions. As I understand the CBO's projections, yes, the government is required to outlay some money, but in the end, the whole thought is it saves a lot of money to American society because it encourages people, for example, to get preventive care so that they take care of themselves before you have the heart attack, before you have the diabetes, which is ultimately far more expensive to the American taxpayer and people.
And finally, before we let you go, the lawsuit before the Supreme Court involves some 26 states who are opposing the law. There's a smattering of individuals, a business group, and groups like the Cato Institute and so forth. A number of states have refused grant money or refused to set up insurance exchanges called for in the Affordable Care Act. Can you envision a scenario where that might continue, even if the court upholds the law, where a number of states might just not comply? And if so, what happens then?
Well, I think that the terms of the Affordable Care Act do give the states a fair amount of wiggle room and to do things as they see fit. The Affordable Care Act was not designed as some sort of one-size-fits-all solution from Washington. There's lots of discretion given to the states. But on the kind of fundamental question, which is, should our insurance companies be able to discriminate against those with pre-existing conditions and thereby price out approximately 50 million Americans from the health insurance markets, the federal government in the Congress said, no, you can't do that. That's something that we're not going to leave to the choice of individual states.
Neil Cutyell is the former acting Solicitor General of the United States. In that role, he defended the Affordable Care Act in lower courts. He's currently a professor at the Georgetown Law Center and a partner at the international law firm Hogan Lovells in Washington, D.C., and we reached him there. Mr. Cutyell, Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll continue our conversation about the health care law on Monday as the Supreme Court begins hearing oral arguments, and we hope you will join us.
Let's say you apply to law schools. You don't get into any school that makes it into lists of the top 25 rated schools or even the top 50. Is it worth it? Let's say you look at the statements made by the schools that did accept you about how many of their graduates find work. And let's say you're sufficiently impressed that you go to that school, graduate, pass the bar exam, and then find no work as a lawyer. Did the law school deceive you? Were its numbers fraudulent? Well, that's what's alleged in a lawsuit that was dismissed by a New York judge this week. In that case, graduates of New York Law School, that's not NYU, but New York Law School, were the plaintiffs. But the lawyers who are running this law school litigation project have suits against 13 other law schools. One of those lawyers, Frank Raymond, joins us from New York.
Thank you.
The judge in New York found against you, and he writes in part that just as you've been able to present much public information that conflicts with New York Law School's claims about its graduates' careers, your plaintiffs could have read the same reports and articles and on the basis of that decided not to believe New York law, not to go there.
A lot of the articles and a lot of the materials he cites come from 2011, and all of our class representatives graduated in 2007, 2008, 2009. Those materials were not available to them. And further, if you go back in time, as it were, to that, to 2007, 2008, 2009, there were anecdotal discussions of how the law graduate employment market was suffering. But there was no quantification of this. There was no connection between these abstract hiring problems at large firms and a concrete relationship between that and what the law schools are saying.
But these aren't just any ordinary consumers who are being told buyer beware here. These are all people who are deep into or already finished with their college education. They're anticipating a career in the law. We would assume some kind of powers of analysis here that they would bring to this question.
However, under the law, the question is whether or not they're a reasonable consumer. And, you know, there is a separate concept in the law of sophisticated consumers, but we feel strongly that that would not apply to our clients here. Ordinarily, sophisticated consumers are multinational banks, people who have lawyers representing them, not 22-year-old kids out of college. And we feel, and we will argue on appeal, that a lot of the inferential leaps that the judge imposes upon the reasonable consumer are not what the law requires.
Well, I want you to explain how it is that a law school could report out a number which purports to be how many of their graduates within 9 months of graduating are working, which looks huge, and a much smaller number of how many people have the kind of job that people go to law school to get.
Sure. So the employment rate for a law school includes any job whatsoever. You're working at Starbucks, you're working at Jackhammer, you're considered employed by the law school. And we think that applicants going to law school and looking to get a law degree probably aren't looking to work at Jackhammer.
I was reminded in reading about your suit that someone pointed out to me some years ago that every year American colleges graduate more journalism majors than there are jobs in American journalism. Mm-hmm. We could fill the entire profession with the number of people who graduate with that degree. This seems to be a pervasive issue in universities that we don't, except perhaps for doctors, we don't control the number of seats with the number of positions they will find upon getting their degree.
And we do feel that there is a larger question going on here about higher education in general in this country and the costs that are imposed upon students and why it keeps increasing and what the connection is between the investment in a college degree and or education generally and what the value of it is. And these cases are a microcosm of that larger question.
Well, Mr. Raymond, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
It's Frank Raymond, a lawyer who is part of the Law School Litigation Project. Their suit against New York Law School was dismissed this week in New York.
Some news today for struggling homeowners. Bank of America has announced a plan to turn them into renters in their own houses. The bank says the pilot program will help homeowners avoid foreclosure. Critics say the bank is missing the point, as NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Certainly, if there's really no other way to avoid a foreclosure, becoming a renter in the same house might be attractive. That's how Bank of America executive Ron Sturzenegger explained it earlier today. He said the effort is starting small. The bank is reaching out to about 1,000 homeowners.
The reason we've identified these 1,000 is because they're 90 days behind on their current mortgage. They are in the foreclosure process already, so they generally know the direction they're heading. And we're trying to contact them and say, would you like to avoid foreclosure by becoming a tenant?
Sturzenegger was speaking to CNBC to announce the new effort, but critics say that these homeowners are exactly the kind of people who the banks should be working out loan modifications for so that they can stay in their houses as owners.
And if they are paying rent, that rent should be a mortgage payment.
Bruce Marks heads up the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America.
Therefore, the banks need to modify the mortgages to keep them as homeowners and not to set up this program that will benefit investors and make these homeowners into renters.
The bank says that it's only offering this program to people who don't qualify for loan modifications or who haven't been responsive to that. But lawyer Gary Klein is skeptical. He is suing Bank of America for wrongfully rejecting thousands of homeowners who he says should have qualified for a federal program to modify their loans and keep them in their houses.
This is a company that has failed working with homeowners to help them lower their mortgage payments.
Bill Wheaton, an economist at MIT, said that the program probably reflects a growing demand for rental properties from investors. He would like to see the bank create a good rent-to-buy option for the homeowners as part of the program. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Well, one battle to stay alive, The Hunger Games, is likely to be the big movie hit this weekend. It's the movie based on a novel aimed at teenagers and young adults. If you are looking for a more mature film-going experience, Kenneth Turan suggests The Deep Blue Sea, and here is his review.
This is a film as fiercely committed to passion as its heroine, and that's saying a lot. The time is around 1950. The city is a war-ravaged London. We watch as Hester Collier, beautifully played by Rachel Weisz, methodically attempts to take her own life. Then we flash back to her past, her high status but conventional marriage to a judge whose family is ice cold.
Will you be going to Wimbledon this year, Mother?
No. Since your father's death, I've not been able to enjoy tennis. Do you play?
Tennis?
Anything.
I occasionally play a hand at canasta.
Cards are a pastime. I meant a sport.
I just find it very hard to be passionate about it.
Beware of passion, Hester. It always leads to something ugly.
She falls heedlessly in love with Freddy, a heroic RAF fighter pilot played by Tom Hiddleston. He awakens passions in her, both physical and emotional, that she hadn't suspected existed.
One can't go on living on a flat plane. Not after discovering something more...
primitive.
Oh, Bill. Do you honestly think I can tell you in sober truth what it is I feel for Freddy? Lust isn't the whole of life, but Freddy is, you see, for me, the whole of life.
Hester is a woman whose belief in the deepest and most profound kind of love puts her at odds with both the men in her life and the drab post-war British society she lives in. The relationships between these three people, wife, lover, husband, plays out unexpectedly in The Deep Blue Sea. Feelings change and characters take positions different from those you'd expect them to have. and in Weiss's hands, Hester's love never feels less than genuine and powerful. She allows us to experience how difficult existing between the devil and the deep blue sea truly is.
The voice of Kenneth Turan, who reviews movies for Morning Edition and for the Los Angeles Times.
President Obama was asked about the Trayvon Martin case today, and here's part of what he said.
I can only imagine what these parents are going through. And when I think about this boy, I think about my own kids.
He said if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. And that's where we'll begin with our regular political commentators, columnists David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to see you both.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk about the death of Trayvon Martin. We've heard just now some statements by people who are by the president and his likely rivals. Rick Santorum, David Brooks, sounded the strongest, saying it was terrible that they didn't prosecute the gunman.
Yeah, I thought his statement was good. I thought the president's statement was good. He doesn't usually get personal, but I thought the statement about what his son would look like was quite appropriate and quite a good minimalist but elegant and forceful statement. One of the issues that hasn't been talked about is just citizenship, what citizenship is. If you're doing community watch, you're supposed to be the eyes and ears of the police. You're not supposed to be some sort of grandiose Dirty Harry going out meeting justice. And to me, one of the things I'm amazed the police weren't offended by this guy who went against what the 911
dispatcher was telling him,
and sort of, as far as we know, and we don't know that much, as far as we know, sort of took things into his hand by being aggressive, and this is an offensive to the idea that the state has a monopoly on force.
EJ, thoughts about this?
I agree with David that both the president and Santorum spoke well on this. When I was listening to the president, I was reminded that very recently a friend of mine who's white was teaching in an eighth grade in an inner city Catholic school, and during a field trip, they stopped at a rest stop, and all of these African-American kids poured out of the bus, and my friend said of seeing a lady with her, white woman with her child, and as soon as she saw these black men, young black men, she just grabbed her child and got very nervous. And then she saw the two white teachers and relaxed. And my friend was very silent for a long time, and one of the kids put his arm on him and said, "Don't worry, this happens to us all the time." It's very hard being a young black man, and it doesn't mean we're all racist. It doesn't mean we haven't made racial progress. And I think these stand-your-ground laws are so dangerous because they're based on subjective feeling of being threatened, which is the last thing a conservative should want law based on. And I think they're especially threatening to young black men because a lot of white people do feel threatened by them, and we got to face it.
The law does have reasonably in it somewhere, so that there is some standard by which you should be reacting. It's not sheer gut.
It's very hard to determine what reasonable means, and it does sort of seem based on gut.
Let's move on to some other matters, David. This week, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, proposed a budget. He said he wanted to give the GOP presidential nominee, whoever that might be, an alternative that contrasts with President Obama's budget. Are Congressman Ryan's ideas etched in stone for the ticket in the fall, or might they prove more ephemeral, like, I don't know, a sketch on a magic slate or something like that?
What's actually interesting is how Paul Ryan has become sort of from being the edge of the Republican Party to being the center. And though what was interesting is how much he got attacked from the right for this budget, because at no time over the next 10 years does it actually balance the budget. It increases spending by $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years and increases spending about 3% a year. So there's a lot of spending in there. There's a lot of government in there. But at least he has gone farther than anybody else, and it doesn't tell how he's going to pay for everything, but he's gone farther than anybody else to getting us to avoid a fiscal catastrophe. And so for that, it's not my perfect budget, but for that, I think he deserves a lot of credit, and it's an enormous political risk for the Republican Party, for which I think they're to be saluted.
But is it a basis for potential talks, EJ, at the end of this year, to avoid massive sequestration of spending and the blanket expiration of all the Bush tax cuts?
I think the answer is absolutely not. And I don't see what's courageous about a Republican budget that continues $5.4 trillion in the Bush tax cuts. And then on top of that, adds $4.6 trillion in tax cuts by cutting the top rate. And he eviscerates government in the process. Now, Ryan says, oh, we'll have tax reform. But there's nothing specific about what he would take away. And so I think that, in fact, this becomes a serious campaign issue. Bob Greenstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a more progressive group, said that this would be one of the most massive redistributionist budgets from bottom to top. And I think that's what it is.
David?
Well, you know, first of all, it doesn't eviscerate government. As I mentioned, it goes up 3% a year. It's only 13% over the next 10 years, less than what Obama is proposing. But it is a serious budget. It is a budget that gets us in the direction of not having a fiscal catastrophe. If the Democrats can come up with a budget, their own budget, which gets us in the direction of avoiding a fiscal catastrophe, then we can compare two plans. But so far, we have one plan.
I want us to look ahead to next week a little bit. 3 days of arguments at the Supreme Court over the health care law, which is viewed so differently by its supporters and its opponents. This is what Barack Obama said when he signed it into law 2 years ago.
The bill I'm signing will set in motion reforms that generations of Americans have fought for and marched for and hungered to see.
For conservatives like Rick Santorum, this same law is an assault on American liberty.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the beginning of the end of freedom in America. Once the government has control of your life, then they got you.
There are going to be technical arguments before the court, E.J. Dionne. These are not technical differences we're talking about. These are basic issues of what government's supposed to be doing.
No, and they are. I think this argument is very disturbing. By Rick Santorum's definition, every Western European nation that has some system of national health insurance is somehow not a free country. And there's an enormous irony here, because the healthcare mandate, the mandate to buy health insurance, was originally a conservative idea. And conservatives said, quite reasonably, that there are rules that say if you walk into an emergency room, you have to get care, which is true. Well, somebody's got to pay for that care. And what the mandate says is we're going to share the costs.
David?
Yeah, I don't think it's the road to serfdom, I guess, as Rick Santorum believes. But I do think it is a fundamental argument we're going to have this election. We have a fundamental disagreement about what cost control is. Republicans tend to think you've got to create some market competition. Democrats tend to believe in this top-down IPEB rationing board. That's a fundamental disagreement. We'll have it.
David Brooks, E.J. Dionne, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.